This is the panel on making the Great Lakes great again, and so we're going to talk a little bit about some of the struggles of managing this the largest freshwater system on the planet that is touches 8 states and 2 Canadian provinces. So, so hopefully you've come with some questions, and we've got 3 distinguished panelists here, and we're going to start with Dave Dempsey, who is a senior advisor for FLO, which is For Love of Water, a Traverse City, Michigan-based not-for-profit organization. He's also the former policy advisor of the International Joint Commission, which is a binational body, so it's the United States and Canada. And also, just so you know, my name is Lynette Wilson. I am a Ted Scripps Fellow at the Center for Environmental Journalism. And I'm taking over this panel for a Canadian journalist named Saul Chernos, who proposed it and who was unable to be here. So we are going to start with Dave.
Thanks, Lynette. A couple of things. I just wanted to describe where I've been and where I'm at organizationally, not because it's that important where I've been, but just the organizations need to be placed in the context of the Great Lakes. Left in January, the International Joint Commission, which, as Lynette said, is a binational U.S.-Canadian body that tries to prevent and resolve disputes over boundary waters shared between the U.S. and Canada. About 40% of the U.S.-Canadian boundary is water, and of course the biggest aspect of that is the Great Lakes. So the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909 set up the commission, and one of its primary functions is to advise the U.S. and Canadian governments on Great Lakes policy. And they will be issuing, and you should watch for this later this month, a sort of State of the Great Lakes report, Quality of the Great Lakes, that will be, I think, very interesting to read. Right now I work at the For Love of Water, which, as Lynette said, is based in Traverse City, Michigan. It's a nonprofit organization. And it is, I think, distinct from all the other Great Lakes advocacy organizations. We're organized around something called the Public Trust Doctrine, which is a principle of law that reaches back 1,500 years to the Roman Empire and essentially says that there are some aspects of nature that cannot be privately owned, the water in particular. The codes of Justinian in the Roman Empire basically codified that water is not subject to private ownership. The ownership belongs to the public, all of us. And so we operationalize that in a number of issues. We're working on the threat of Line 5 at the Straits of Mackinac, the potential for a catastrophic oil spill. We're fighting the proposal for increased water extraction by Nestle in Michigan. And we're also working on aquaculture proposals to, in essence, put factory farms, fish farms in the Great Lakes. Turning to the topic, I'm going to be very brief so we can get into questions after my fellow panelists speak. I take issue a little bit with the title, which is Making the Great Lakes Great Again. Great Lakes will always be great. It's whether we are great that is at some risk, or at some debate, I should say, or at issue. The Great Lakes are vast, they are robust, they are a source of inspiration to artists and all of us who live in the basin. That doesn't change. What does change is how we think of them and how we treat them. And just looking at it pragmatically right now, I would say we treat them as an afterthought or even as a sewer in some cases. I could give you a complete dissertation on the Great Lakes, but I think the problem on the minds of many of us working on these issues right now is the algae bloom in Western Lake Erie. And I go back to the 1960s and 70s, which was in my youth, when we basically took a green cesspool in 1966 when I went to the beach at Point Pelee to a really aesthetically pleasing lake in 1975 when I went swimming off Put-In Bay. We've shown before we can restore and clean up a lake like this, but today I'm not sure that there is a parallel to the 60s and 70s. What we're facing is a political taboo, and the taboo is addressing agricultural pollution. I'd be the first to admit that you can't issue a permit for every farm in the Lake Erie Basin and say how many pounds of phosphorus each can release, but neither can we continue passing out big checks to farms that are contributing phosphorus runoff to the Great Lakes. We need to have some kind of effort where necessary to set standards and require farms to meet those standards. And until we do, Western Lake Erie is going to continue to struggle. So I think that's a good way to start the conversation.
Okay, and next we have John Allen, who's the director of Michigan's Office of the Great Lakes, which is part of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality.
Hi, great to be here. So we're an interesting shop within state government. Office of the Great Lakes is about a 30-year organization. It was founded under a Governor Blanchard a long time ago, and then Governor Engler created it as a separate cabinet position. Recognizing Michigan's role in the Great Lakes has been pretty profound on behalf of 9.8 million people, continued under Granholm, continued under Snyder in that capacity. So administratively, we fall under DEQ because we're a pretty small shop. I spent a fair amount of my career, just for background, in private sector, consumers energy in particular, as a electric and gas utility in Michigan. So I came in at the governor's request about four and a half years ago. The Great Lakes, as Dave said, are really a vast system, and I also sort of have squirmed a little bit at the title because the Great Lakes are also great. They are under a significant amount of challenge. We'll talk some about some of those challenges and how we sort of see the contours of those challenges. But make no mistake that these are really phenomenal systems. And the amount of investment that we've made over the last 30 to 50 years, I would argue trillions of dollars, I've never really added it up. Chicago, Cleveland, Milwaukee, all the cities and stormwater and infrastructure and systems to take what was really dead and dying systems of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I also grew up in northern Ohio on Lake Erie and understand and spend lots of time on Lake Erie and realize what kind of shape it was in at that time. We have made substantial progress on what I'll call a class of point source problems. We understood and learned our way and invented tools through that time frame on a set and a class of problems that we see as very much point source, end of pipe, end of stack kinds of problems, whether those were from individual corporate actors or from municipal systems that were dumping sewage and in some cases still are, depending on how much it rains, into the system. So I argue that we've made really substantial progress from the days. I like to say when I grew up in Elyria, Ohio, on the Black River. Tuesday was Blue Day and Thursday was Orange Day because that's whatever was coming out of the chemical company there in town on those days. And we've come a long way since then. That doesn't mean our systems are healthy. That doesn't mean that we don't have a set of problems. But what we've really transitioned to, and the work there is not all done, don't get me wrong, but what we're really uncovering and really understanding is a whole different class of problem that we really haven't fully tackled. Dave alluded to it, and that's a whole class of distributed problems or non-point source problems. Not just in non-point source agricultural farms, but think about invasive species as a class of distributed problem. Vectors are coming. There is no one vector that all invasive species come from. There is a series of vectors. It is a series of things for phosphorus. It's a series of things for plastics. We see estimates of up to 3 elephant loads of plastics are coming out every time you wash your fleece. That releases a little more fleece into your laundry systems headed out into the Great Lakes. So we've talked about that as a set of distributed problems. That's millions of actors participating in that, not just one bad actor. Sediments and the whole range of things that we see as sort of a set of class of problems that we're still, quite frankly, inventing our way into. We're still thinking about and trying to develop the ways that we deal with a set of distributed problems as opposed to the point source actors. We've lived in the Great Lakes with this narrative of victim, villain, and hero, sort of this very acute looking for the bad actor and regulating the bad actor. And now we really have to really recast what we think that narrative looks like as we look at systems. I will say there's a couple of other kind of contextualizers that we think about, that the systems we're dealing with, the Great Lakes, have deeply long memories. The water that's flowing through the St. Mary's River in the UP is carrying water that may have a 300-year memory, roughly a 300-plus-year retention time of water. That is a long time to clear legacy out of a system, right? Sediments in particular have deeply long memories. as we deal with phosphorus inputs in the farming systems, and we'll talk a little bit about that, we're also seeing that there's a lot of phosphorus built up as memory in the systems, both in farms and in non-farm systems. There's a couple of other elements that I think we'll get to. I think I'll stop there because I know we want to really have more of a dialogue both with each other and with you. We're also looking at the Great Lakes, though, that sits within a $5 trillion economy. The Great Lakes, from Duluth all the way out to the Gaspé Peninsula, all the way out to the Gulf of St. Lawrence, is our water system. It's not just the lakes themselves. It's also the St. Lawrence. And we have to be deeply mindful that whatever we do here shows up in the drinking water of Montreal, et cetera, all the way out into the Gulf of St. Lawrence. So the health of the Great Lakes drives everything down gradient from there. So one of the questions we have, how does a $5 trillion economy, which could amount to really the third largest economy in the world, if you kind of looked at it that way, how does that economy service the underlying need to manage the Great Lakes at real time at scale to healthy endpoints for healthy people, healthy communities, and healthy functional systems? So we'll get into that conversation.
Okay. And finally, we have John Dickert, who is the former mayor of Racine, Wisconsin, and who is now president and CEO of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
So you're the ones that are going to be the most excited because you're going to get more stories out of this panel than anybody else, and they're all going to be jealous of you. So, you know, they can't hear it from here, but they're all going to be going back on, oh, I wish I woulda. And you're like, I know. So I work for the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, which is 131 mayors representing the Great Lakes and the tributaries, all the way up through past Quebec, north of Quebec. So you're not going to believe this, but the mayor is going to give the shortest speech of this entire group. So that's going to freak you out a little bit. It's going to freak these guys out. But it really, what we came here to do was have a conversation and also have a conversation with you, right? We're going to get into some of the dialogue as we did earlier at the table before we got here, and I'll tell you, it's a great dialogue, so I'm just prefacing that. So let me just tell you this. From a guy who worked at every level of government, local, state, and federal, has been elected at two levels of government, and now works for this NGO, every problem can be solved. So you're going to hear about some things today, and sometimes you may think to yourself, well, that sounds pretty futile. Well, we created it. So if we created it, we're smart enough to fix it. But what we're going to talk about today is some of the barriers that may be there, but also some of the challenges that are there within the topic item, okay? So what I'm going to tell you, and I'll give you your first story line, is that the Great Lakes are great, and they look like that from the air. But below, the situation is as grave as it was when they created the Clean Water Act. You just don't see it. So let's get going.
Provocative.
I know.
Well, let's start there then with some of the things that we don't see. What are some of the things that we're not seeing? Because we do see, and I'm sure you'll get questions about the Asian carp and you'll get questions about the zebra mussels, but there are other things that are happening also in the Great Lakes. So what are some of the things that are happening beneath the surface that we're not seeing?
Well, first of all, we start with, if you haven't heard of quagga and zebra mussels, closer. If you haven't heard of quagga and zebra mussels, they're these invasives that have come in and they replicate in our Great Lakes, and they usually, the females, are a little bit more productive than rabbits are. They put out about 1 million eggs at a time. So when they reproduce, it's pretty good. Right now, if you walked across Lake Michigan and you took out all the water, you wouldn't touch sand. That's how many there are in Lake Michigan. So, and by the way, when they cut you because they're really sharp, your leg gets infective, and then you have to go to the hospital and get massive doses of treatment of antibiotics. But here's the thing. They eat everything, literally everything. And if you take a piece of metal and throw it on the ground in Lake Michigan and wait for a little while, there'll be about 100,000 of them on that 1 by 1 square foot piece of metal. So they grow quickly, they eat everything, and they make the water pure and clean. The only problem is the water is not supposed to be pure and clean, and you're not supposed to see 70 feet down in Lake Michigan. So they could literally eat the lake alive. And by the way, they're like growing. They're going all over the Great Lakes. So we worry about the fact that these two little mussels could virtually eat the lake alive. Now, the other thing is they attach to anything that's hard. So we, in the city of Racine, for instance, and I'll leave you with this, we spend $100,000 a year with a little ring around our intake valves that pushes out a chemical that just leaves them off. Plus, we have to send divers down every year to scrape them off. And the inherent that they make out of their saliva that attaches them to stuff, it's not easy to do. So this is just one of hundreds of invasives that are in our Great Lakes.
I think there's a whole series of things. In the 60s and the 70s, we saw lakes dying. We saw fish piling up on our shores. We saw rivers burning. We saw the manifestations of what had been really a century of abuse. We saw most of that. We saw people cut off from their waterfront. We saw beaches that were unhealthy. We saw rings around boats. We saw lots of things. And I think John is right. A lot of the things we're dealing with, probably with the big exception of algae in Lake Erie, which manifests itself as a very visible piece, it's hard to see the toxic remains in sediments. That's not something you see, even though there's risk there and exorbitant amount of cost to remove remaining PCBs and other things from our sediments. So there are any number of pieces that are happening sort of in this distributed. It's hard to see microplastics, right? These are not things that are going to sort of flash up and be a good front page story or a front page photograph. That it, we're also talking about interactions in very complex systems. And complexity is not an easy storyline. Really, understanding the notion of zebra and quagga mussels coming in, kind of life in the wrong place, right? Biological pollution, which second top line story for you is a national crisis. This isn't just a Great Lakes crisis. The way that we move life around the planet now, the ubiquity of the distributions of things where their homes weren't, right, where they don't have biological controls, is just profound. And we're not dealing with this sort of as a national crisis that it is. We're trying to deal with this as spot issues in spot locations. But this is a really deeper problem that's very hard to get your hands around because you can't see it as much. You may see it in terms of Phragmites, certain species, but generally it's not noticeable. So I don't disagree with the narrative that he provides in many cases.
John, Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade. Yeah. Met you, IGNR, up in Racine. With all due respect, I know you didn't come here to talk about quagga mussels. So let's get it out on the table. How do you feel about Waukesha's effluent coming down towards your beaches there in Racine? Given the time that's passed, although they probably don't have it operational yet. Have you given it any more thought? Are you more willing to accept that now, or less willing? You were certainly not when we came to your office, and Racine certainly were not pleased by the prospect of even highly treated effluent that was promised to be clean coming down and potentially impacting your beaches there.
Right.
Before you respond, just for the audio.
Yeah.
Thomas is asking about effluent coming down from Waukesha and washing up on the beaches in Racine, Wisconsin.
All right, so now you're going to hear the politician answer, prefaced by the NGO answer, prefaced by the way to talk about it, that we need to talk about it. So all three in one answer. First of all, I'm not the mayor of Racine anymore, and I was battling on that side, and when I came into the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, the first thing that I had to do was to negotiate the final premise of the Waukesha debate, which ended up being the fact that we were going to redo the process or try to fix the process. Because the biggest thing with the Great Lakes Compact is that you have a compact in the process we felt was flawed. Now, the people of Racine, I don't believe, are going to stop fighting the Waukesha issue. And for all of you that don't know, Waukesha is getting water from the Great Lakes, but they want to dump the effluent, their wastewater stream, down the Root River, which runs through the heart of Racine. and empties out next to the lake, Lake Michigan's Beach, North Beach in Racine, which is the number one tourist attraction in the entire county. So it's for the people of Racine, water is our DNA. It's important to us. They're not real happy about this. So we have to try to work through this process, because here's the thing, and this is a point that I'm not trying to circumvent this issue, but I think is really important to understand. So we were in, as we were just talking about, we were the Rust Belt. They call us the Rust Belt, which I think is crap, by the way. It's the worst conversational way to describe the Midwest. Tom Barrett had a great way of, third story, stop saying that. Tom Barrett had a great, the mayor of Milwaukee had a better way of describing us. West Coast, East Coast, Fresh Coast. Because like we tell everybody, we're the Great Lakes. We're unsalted and shark-free. So we are the Fresh Coast. Now, here's the reality. In my humble view, the reality is that you're seeing people use up water and aquifers in areas where, let's be honest, that used to be a desert, okay? And we have areas of this country that may be filling up that won't be usable either. So where is industry going to come back to that uses heavy water? They're not going to go into aquifers that can't do 10 million gallons or 20 million gallons a day, because it's not sustainable for the people that actually want to drink the water. So there's going to be this infusion of new companies coming back into the Midwest. Why? Not because they could create industry with pollution and dump it in the lakes and use it, as John said, as the sewer, but because they need that volume of sustainable water. So what we're saying about Waukesha and Foxconn and all of them is, do not throw out the environmental issues just because you want to attract a company. Because the two actually work together. You can actually, we are smart enough. The Romans may have started it, but we're smarter, hopefully. We are smart enough to make an engineer a system of building our economy while protecting the environment. And if political officials simply throw out that issue and say, I'm going to disband all the environmental issues because I want to bring X company in, you have set a precedent where you're going to go back to the 50s and you're going to degrade it. And then guess who's going to have to clean up all that crap again? The taxpayers, who just cleaned it up for the last 20 years. So we have to stop this methodology that those two do not interact. Economic development and the environment can match, and they can work systematically together. So whether it's Waukesha, Foxconn, or anybody else, our battle as the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative is to make sure that these elected officials start thinking about the next generation, not the next election.
Well, as a quick follow-up, and I know Jay would like to weigh in on this too, if water is going to be the attraction to industry, I think everyone has been thinking of manufacturing, that these manufacturers or other, maybe not even manufacturers, but other businesses will be coming here.
Yeah.
But in some ways, it's happening now with agriculture. I've heard that, you know, some of the bankrupt CAFOs that were started by Dutch dairy farms are being bought out by California farmers who want to come here because of water.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not a real huge trend right now, but I found it very interesting. While everyone's thinking that eventually someday, you know, the hardcore manufacturers or whatever we have, it may actually be happening now with agriculture. And I wondered, your thoughts on that. If we are getting, if this is the beginning of a trend, and whether it's California farmers or others, what do we do to protect the water source here for an industry that is, you know, has a lot of fingers pointed at it now anyways, with the algae problem and runoff, if agriculture is really the one moving in because of water.
Do you want to repeat the question so we've got it?
Well, the question is exactly, could you state it in a...
What more can we do to protect our water source now if agriculture is attracting, you know, more, is really the new wave of investment here?
Yeah. So if new investment, the question is, if new investment, not only industrial, but ag, starts flowing back to the Midwest, what do we do to protect it, in essence? Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. So I'll just give one quick brief answer, and that is the fourth one, that fourth issue you guys get to write about today, which is start asking questions. Nobody's asking questions on Foxconn about the environmental side of this. Nobody is. All right, Chuck Hornbach is. Yeah. That's why I love Chuck. But the fact is that where are the people saying, everybody's saying, oh, this is great, Taiwan's coming in, the president's excited about it. Hey, you know what? We're all excited about jobs, right? Yippee-ki-yay. I get it. But who's asking about the other side of it? And when you've got a governor that's come out and said, hey, listen, all environmental standards are off on a 1 million square foot industry, we say, no, they shouldn't be. Because we have the technology to work with you to make sure that this isn't a problem. So who's asking questions about what specifically are you doing? Are you doing pretreatment? You're using 10 million gallons of water a day? The city of Racine pumps out to the entire region 15 million gallons a day. This is a big deal. And you know what? Here's the fifth piece for you guys. This is going to be happening a lot. So if there isn't checks and balances on this, then we're going to be back to where we were before.
I just want to say one thing, well, two things. One is that if we decide as a region that the kind of industry we want to attract to use our sustainable water is agriculture, we're in deep trouble. The agribusiness lobby is to the environment as the NRA is to firearms. You cannot touch that lobby. You cannot regulate the members of that lobby. And I'm not talking about Joe and Jill Farmer. I'm talking about industrial agriculture. So I would strongly oppose turning to agriculture as the industry that's going to save us through its use of water. On the Waukesha thing, I just have to get something off my chest. The Waukesha diversion is the first that was approved under the Great Lakes Compact, and of course it complies with the compact because the compact was written specifically to let Waukesha take Great Lakes water. There's a loophole in the compact. So we can discuss the process, we can discuss the science, but basically it's a special interest exemption. I don't know that the people of Waukesha realize that there are special interests, but they are. What's that? They got the final approval last year, I believe, after the mayor's appeal.
A couple things, just briefly. One, interestingly enough, when the final decision for Waukesha was crafted, essentially more water is returned to the basin than was before. There was already water moving out of the basin. So net-net, there was actually a return of water flowing that had been intercepted by the set of wells, the high extractive wells. So I think on balance, the Great Lakes fared fairly well with that. And I really do want to applaud John and his team when he came into the city's initiative to really craft an agreement with the Compact Council to really take a very deep look at that process, something that we support, and I think something that was really an important avenue of moving ahead together. So I want to applaud them for the work there as they really saw what the next path was and what public comment, what engagement, what all the important hallmarks of working together in a shared governance and over shared resources looks like. That could have been a very long, protracted conversation, and I think this was a great kind of great place to get to as you took over the helm there. So thank you for that. To the groundwater piece in particular, and all I can do is speak for Michigan, that we crafted in Michigan a number of years ago in our implementation of the compact, in our look at the compact. It wasn't only about diversions, but Michigan has comprehensive structure around the removal of groundwater. And it is protective of water-dependent natural resources, which is really the fundamental piece in this multi-state, multi-provincial agreement. And Michigan looks very closely at every single water withdrawal for its effect on surface water resources. So it's not that any one industry, it's not that ag is or isn't regulated. Everybody is looked at, all water withdrawals are looked at with an eye towards, are those withdrawals sustainable and do they comport with the principles under the compact? So there's this is something that we've been working on for, 10 plus years or so, that water withdrawals in Michigan do have a regulatory overlay, and that regulatory overlay comports with the principles of the compact for the protection of surface water systems. So whether it's Foxconn in another state, and I don't have a comment on that because that's another state, but whether it's agriculture in Michigan, whether it's Nestle's, whatever that issue is, they are all looked at with the lens of, does water withdrawals in Michigan, is it likely to cause or not likely to cause impact to water and water-dependent natural resources? And I think that's the lens by which we continue to look at groundwater. So groundwater is a resource that has a structure around it for decision-making.
Well, I was going to ask how much of this is driven by Nestle.
How much of what is driven by Nestle?
The emphasis on groundwater withdrawals that you mentioned.
Nothing. I mean, originally nothing. This wasn't a Nestle response. This was a response to the compact. And how does Michigan implement a compact in a state that is wholly within the Great Lakes Basin? Michigan doesn't have a Waukesha. Michigan doesn't have an Akron.
Well, Jennifer Granholm responded very strongly to Nestle when she was in office as governor, and I think the agreement was, if I remember right, that it was a compromise and Nestle wasn't going to sell what it bottles in West Michigan outside of the Great Lakes region.
I don't know what Nestle's distribution is.
Maybe you can help me.
Well, Governor Granholm responded strongly to Nestle by helping them get their permit, basically.
Right.
I'm a little surprised. I wasn't aware that the water withdrawal statute applies to agricultural withdrawals.
It applies to all withdrawals over a certain amount, 100,000 gallons a day. In Michigan.
Including water for fracking.
It was regardless of use. 100,000 gallons a day or more is looked at for its effect on freshwater, surface water systems. We did not, at that time of crafting that, specify that one use or another was more important than another. We said water removed from groundwater for whatever purpose has the same effect, whether I take it out 100,000 gallons to feed my dog or to do whatever with it, still has the 100,000 gallons of impact to the aquifer. And we were really interested in the relationship between the removal of water from aquifer to the surface water systems. That's our obligation under the compact, to manage water holistically, thinking about its relationships to water and water-dependent natural resources. That's the business end of this. That's what the compact obligates us to do. And Michigan has a comprehensive set of rules around how we do that. Now, you may argue that the curves are in the right place or the right number. I will argue that they are. But it is a universal categorical standard for the state of Michigan.
It's a tool that has great potential. It's been touted as sort of a model for the nation. But my understanding and the most recent Nestle proposal is that the screening tool, showed that it would not be acceptable in terms of the impact. Well, Nestle gets to go and then say, well, we're going to do a site-specific thing even though we flunked the model.
That's not a fair characterization.
So we're getting into the weeds on West Nestle, but let's talk about this from a little bit grander perspective, okay? So you've got, in the last 10 or 15 years in the census, if you look at the census numbers, the majority of the people moved out of the Midwest into areas south and west, right? So Texas is growing, Arizona, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Florida and everybody else. So they're all growing, but yet they're having more and more trouble with water, okay? So as we said earlier, if you move out into a desert, don't expect to be the Midwest, the green, lush Midwest, right? But what moved with that was congressional numbers. So one of the things that we look at as Great Lakes mayors and an organization is the Great Lakes recharges about 1% per year. So if you take out 2%, we got a problem, right? You take out too much water, what do? You spend more than $400 million a year that we do right now, roughly, on dredging. You spend a lot more than that on dredging because now the water levels are low, or your certain parts of your area are exposed, whatever the case is. As the water rises and falls, you have impacts. So what we look at is that, okay, let's just say Nestle's pulling out and they're sending bottled water to Texas now because the people out west don't want to use their bottled water, their aquifers for bottled water, so we're going to get it somewhere else, blah, blah, blah. The whole thing starts growing. This whole issue on changes in the climate start growing. Okay, so Nestle does it with bottled water. What happens if a group comes in from Saudi Arabia and says, we'd like to just grab a tanker, fill it with water, and take the tanker out back to the Middle East? What happens if that becomes oil? then water becomes oil. Everybody looks at these issues and says, well, you know, what's the big deal, right? The big deal is we're looking at those big deals. We're looking at the fact that as populations move into areas where they can't even handle the populations they have with drinking water, and they're growing at 8 people per day per city, we have to start thinking about this, because I've already had mayors asking me if I can pump water through a pipeline like the Keystone Pipeline to Arizona. And my answer was, no. God made you a desert. Be a desert. God made me the Midwest. I don't ask you for 90-degree sunshine in December because you can't give it to me. So I'm not going to give you water because you're going to put it in the sand and it's going to seep through or evaporate, and you'll always ask for more. So we need to start thinking about this a little bit longer term, because we tend to make decisions as elected officials on short-term solutions to make everybody happy, but those aren't always the best answers.
Make no mistake, the Great Lakes... Make no mistake, the Great Lakes, the U.S. and the Canadian province, Ontario, Quebec, have a categorical ban on the wholesale diversion of water out of the Great Lakes.
Right.
In one case, in the Waukesha case, we're talking about a very specific accommodation in that piece that reflects the political reality of a community that sits on the border, right? Which is a very small N, an N of very small numbers. One can argue that that has some or does not have some precedential value, but I think the fact that the Great Lakes have a resource-based, not an economic-based, but a resource-based categorical ban, we think makes it durable. Where we get nervous is when people start to talk about the commodification of water within the region. This company should pay for water because they're doing something I don't want them to do. Once you cross the Rubicon of moving from a natural resource-based conservation standard that gives you authorities, we believe, long-term, durable legal authorities to manifest that ban to a commodification of water internally that allows it to enter into commerce, we think really puts us in a terribly dangerous position. So a lot of this notion that we'll just get Nestle's or somebody or whoever that is that somebody doesn't want to do something to pay for water, the underlying nature of water, commodifies it and takes away what Dave will say is one of the most important pieces, and that's the trust obligations within you know, collective ownership.
I love John Allen. He's a great guy. I totally disagree with him on this one because I think the commodification is happening. We have a company that's selling the public's water, and make no mistake about it, the waters of the state of Michigan belong to the people, and they're making... Who knows? We know hundreds of millions of dollars in profit. I'm sorry, what?
Nestle.
Nestle.
Does it have to do with the size of the bottles? Because it's extracting water from the lakes.
Right, I understand.
No, from groundwater.
The diversion standard is based on a volumetric standard.
Right.
5.7 liters.
Right.
5.7 gallons.
Because it was in smaller bottles?
Can we...
That's two different things.
Yeah. Can we just... So I do want to open it up to other topics that are involved, not just Nestle and taking water out of the Great Lakes, maybe getting back to a little bit about protecting the resource as well. And if you do have a question, then please identify yourself and so we can get that on the record. Okay. So maybe we can go back to some of the... talking about some of the ways that we can protect this water source so that... should we need to ship water to Phoenix, Arizona, it's actually quality water.
And the commodification of water is something that's kind of bantered around. But here's the thing is that what I got to a little bit earlier on the congressional impacts is that because the Midwest has less and less representation, you may have Congress nationally. Who was that? It sounded like, you know, Michael Jackson's Thriller out there for a little while. One of the things that we worry about is not so much us protecting it and all the governors and congressmen and senators of the great Midwest coming together and saying no, but actually Congress saying, hey, we have an area of this country that is in dire need of water, and we're going to mandate that you send it out by federal law, which our governors, senators, and congressmen and women can say, well, no, we're going to stop that. And you just get outnumbered. So these are things that we have seen this country transition due to votes and politics and everything else in ways that don't make us very happy now. So when we talk about digging in on some of these issues, we dig in because we see the numbers. And the numbers for us right now don't add up. What we talked about earlier in our conversation, just so you know the inside of our table talk, was that if there's one thing that you find about the Great Lakes, is when they brought up the GLRI money and the president said, I'm just going to take it out completely. Those folks band together over politics and partisanship and said no. Congress, Senate, everybody came together and said universally, no, we're putting the money back in. So they can band together. That I'm not very concerned about. But when you're outnumbered by a whole lot of states with a whole lot of votes, that's going to be the challenge. Number for that five or six of articles that we're giving them to write. I think that's number five.
Did either of you want to respond to that? Yeah. So the other one, so one of the things that came up the other day, and it was this woman here who had just asked about the water bottles. You were asking about the Enbridge number line five pipeline?
Oh, I was just asking a long time ago when I went to the Georgia International Commission back in the 90s, or something. Yeah. Because I was a reporter, I was just a there was a big issue that it had to do with they could take the water out as long as they packaged it a certain way. And I was just wondering if that's changed or if that's different.
She's talking about the exemption.
Yeah. Right, in the contract.
Still,
in a nutshell, you cannot ship X amount of water out of the Great Lakes in a freighter, but you can ship the same amount of water out of the Great Lakes in a freighter as long as it's in bottles.
Right, and is that still?
Yes.
So, do we have estimates on how much
I'm not aware of it.
It's knowable. The estimates we see that there are up to seven times more water shipped into the region than shipped out in containers. We get more, Fiji and Voss and Norwegian water and water from other places in bottles than we do get out in bottles. That at least those are the estimates.
The permit for the NOVA Group in 1998, which started the compact, was that the proposal was to fill up the ballast of tankers and ship it to Asia. And so that led to the compact, which basically the agreement, and there were agricultural exemptions and so forth, that you could ship in containers of, I think, 5 liters or less.
5.7.
5.7 liters.
Gallons.
Individually filled liters? Up, but you can't fill like a tanker and ship it to another country.
Right. But the concern then was that they would just...
Make no mistake that we ship water in and out of the basin in many forms, water as water as beer, water as milk, water as trees, water as products. We ship water in and out of the basin in water as tomatoes, water as...
As people,
right?
70%.
70%. As Zaphod Beeblebrock said, what, noisy bags of mostly water?
But right? Being near Milwaukee, I will say that beer is a health food, so it's okay to ship it out.
Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Ian. I'm a student at the University of Michigan. And this is a bit of a change of pace, but I want to talk more about the Great Lakes ecosystem.
Yeah, good.
And in the last several decades, it's changed pretty drastically from its native state. We've kind of moved from a Cisco lake trout food chain to an ALA salmon food chain. Most of the salmon we have in our Great Lake are introduced. And they're very popular amongst sport fishers, I know, and there's a huge industry behind it. But the ALA population is collapsing, and as I understand, there may be some tension between the commercial and the sport and the tribal fishing industries. I'm wondering if
Let me start.
So first of all, though, I just want to say talking about the changing ecosystem and moving from more of a trout base to an alewife and a salmon base fishery. How it's changing.
Yeah, on one hand, you actually ask a really deeply important systems question. And the answer is that the lakes we have today will be different than the lakes we have in 10 years. The Lake Erie of 10 years ago will be different than it is today and will be different in 10 years. So there is no there. Right? There is no end state that we manage to. We manage to a set of accommodations over periods of time as both nature and people manifestly change those systems. Right? We had a system, a biological system that was completely out of whack, with alewives dominating the system, piling up on beaches such that we had to remove them in bulldozers because they were rotting and stinking. Now, if you think beach closures are bad today, rotting and stinking piles of alewives on the beach that you have to remove with bulldozers was a bad beach closure.
That was smelly.
That was a system that was completely out of whack. So it probably wouldn't be able to happen. I'll just speculate. Probably wouldn't be able to happen today. But the DNR at that time got both good and lucky. They were smart, but they also got a little bit of lucky, and they introduced salmon, Pacific salmon, into the Great Lakes, several different species of salmon, to try to eat alewives. Otherwise, we were going to be pulling them off the beach with a bulldozer forever, right? So it is not a natural food web system at all. Ballast water, open up of the Welland Canal, all sorts of fisheries changes have happened over, I would argue, a century, not just a couple of decades. What we're seeing now is the loss of the bottom part of the food web, the diaporia and others, that the systems are now equilibrating. What we created, though, ironically and interestingly enough, was a public expectation of what productive system looked like. A highly stocked salmonid system looked like a very productive fishery system, even though it is a social artifact, right? And now with the loss of forage fish, in many cases, maybe the resurgence of some native fish, including trout. Trout are not as sought after as a sport fishery as salmonids. That's causing some tension. But now the public expectation of what a productive system looks like is changing again. Is it more of a naturalized system with less inputs of trout and salmonids, game, sport fish, in a system that's sort of re-equilibrating to a lower level of productivity? It becomes a new social construct for what production system looks like. But make no mistake, it's still a managed system, right? So, but it is a moving target, and it's a moving target not just with the things we stock on purpose, but also the way that the food web is changing underneath that system. It is a profound thing. I ask a lot of my students when I talk to student groups and others, I said, what day is today? Saturday. So by next Wednesday, I want a 20-page paper. And I want a 20-page paper on how do you manage the Great Lakes at real time at scale in a system that's changing every day. Right. But I want 20 pages. So come back and tell me how to do that.
So let me add one thing to that, too. Right now, we spend $200 million a year on invasives. And we're not winning.
Forever.
As long as, again, I'm going to go back to this because I was an elected official and I know what this is like, right? As long as we have people making decisions simply telling certain industries that, we know you guys are strong and, you know, we're not going to push that one, then taxpayers are going to keep paying $200 million or more. And that system that you're talking about, which is not our natural system, is going to constantly be evolving. And if we don't figure out the quagga and zebra mussels, if we don't figure out the issues on the invasives, whether it's the round gobies or the Asian carp, we're going to be chasing this.
Well, we are.
And we are chasing it, and we will be. But here's the thing. It all goes back to that one, and there's no easy answer, right? But when in the world are we going to stop electing people who make decisions based on what's better for them than what's better for us? Because this is getting to a point, and this is my argument about all these bad decisions that are being made. Economically, it's costing us a massive amount of money as taxpayers. So when are we going to stop that? And the only way that we're going to stop that, and this is my suck up to you guys, is that when the press continues to educate, inform, and call out bad decisions and good solutions, okay? Because we have to start thinking about this stuff from an economic level. There's no easy answers. We have done this to ourselves. Mother Nature didn't drop these invasive species necessarily into our areas. But we have to start making decisions because economically, this is going to have a dramatic impact on us.
Dave, did you want to respond?
No, I think
okay.
I'll wait.
Okay.
Do you have a question?
In the back.
Oh, hi. My name is Lynn. I have less of a question and more of something to put in the mix.
Okay.
So I spent time in Green Bay several years ago studying the psychology of how people relate with the Great Lakes.
Interesting. Oh, I'd love to talk to you about that.
She's got great ideas.
Good.
So what I want to put out there is what the psychology of engaging with the Great Lakes means and what it's about. And I'm going to challenge what I'm hearing a little bit, because I think it's more complex and nuanced than telling people what's going wrong, what the solutions are. So what I found in my research that I wrote about in the book that's here is that it relates to the issue of change and that we're dealing with a dynamic system. And what I heard people telling me in these interviews is that they absolutely loved and cherished the Great Lakes, and they felt deep connection, families going back, identity was synonymous with the water and with the lakes.
Completely.
Very profound stuff. Mm-hmm. They knew a lot about the issues that were going on, and at the same time, they were not engaging at all in anything that was happening to protect or preserve or whatever. So this is a dilemma here. So high literacy, not ignorant, but not doing anything. So my question is, what's going on? And what I heard people telling me was that, one, they didn't feel included in the conversation. They felt excluded. So all they want me to do is donate money or sign this, and that's not me. I'm going to just hang out with my kids and whatever, do something else. Mm-hmm. So they felt excluded. And the other thing that I call this environmental melancholia, that there's a interesting loss, issue of loss, around how things used to be. And it's vague, it's kind of amorphous, but it's kind of like vague. Like, we used to swim, my dad used to haul out all kinds of fish, now we can't go in, and I can't take my dog. And then it kind of stays at that level of this resignation. And so what that suggests is that it's really complicated, but there's an enormous opportunity right now to have conversations, to change the conversation around the lakes, that's much more about inviting people in, you know, into the conversation, and framing it in such a way. I know about all the campaigns, like, this is your Great Lakes. I know about changing our water.
So the question is exactly how to engage people around the Great Lakes and the psychology of engagement. And this is something we were discussing earlier today about this, about how education really doesn't cut it necessarily. So,
well, it's a profoundly interesting topic, and I'll just say that I'm working on a book about this, and we should talk. Maybe we can co-author it. I've interviewed 29 people about this issue of where is the why is there a gap between the amount of caring and the amount of doing, whether it's political doing or personal doing, and I've gotten all kinds of answers. I think it's a really complex problem. There's not one explanation. Some people feel the political system is completely corrupt and they can't change it. Some actually. This is one case in Michigan. A person said, well, I live in Ann Arbor, and I worry about the Huron River. I don't have time to think about the Great Lakes. It's not in my backyard, and it's too big. I rarely go there. Some people feel that they don't have the expertise, and they don't know what the problems are. There's a lot of people feel uneducated. They have this broad caring, but not a lot of information. So I think out of the 29 interviews, I got 20 different ideas as to what's wrong, and a few about what's right, too.
I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to hear you talk, because this is, we think, one of the most important questions. One of the ways we contextualize this is, if you think about this from sort of the public's belief, that we've spent $1 trillion, some just enormous amount of money in the Great Lakes to fix things, right, infrastructure. But the narrative that the public keeps hearing is it's worse than it was. And then we think the next best answer is to go and say, but I need more money. At what point does that narrative not resonate? And what point does that actually exacerbate grief or loss or hopelessness versus hopefulness? We think the contours, that sort of that social contour of the relationship between care and action is really the critical piece. We spend a tremendous amount of our time in our office really working with communities, understanding communities, and helping to change the notion from wishing from what was to creating what will be, right? That may be a little bit poetic or prosaic in its notion, but that's the contour that we're seeing. If Great Lakes pulls off the charts at 98%, then why is this so hard? There are whys, right? But the whys aren't a bigger billboard or a louder voice or more laws to compel, right? In some cases they are, some cases they aren't. We think that there's some much deeper social layers to this, and I'm just desperately interested in talking to you about this. We have some, we just did an RFP. We put some work on the street. It was going to be done through Michigan State, working with some folks there, interview-based, conversational-based, on understanding the contours and looking for markers in a community. How do communities manifest sort of the alleles of care, right? Think about it genetically, right? What are those underlying conditions? And there's some work actually we're going to be working on together. Smithsonian Waterways, the Smithsonian is going to be coming through Michigan with a museum on Main Street. And it's a reflection back to communities on what water is and looks like. We've done some work on Michigan's water heritage, and these will be touring at the same time. Dave's going to be a part of that work through the Michigan Council of Humanities. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to understand that it's not just about fish. It is important. Not just about water levels. It is important. Toxic sediments, the ologies, the biologies, but it's also about the human ologies, right? It's all about the contours of the way people look, see, and act. I can't agree with you more.
So let me just throw one last piece, which is that's why I asked you to start or continue to educate people, because there's no simple answer to any of this. You can't just go to a congressman and say, hey, you got to do this or else. Yeah, pass a law or throw more money at it. One of the things that we're looking at doing at the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative is starting to show people the end results of good work which have demonstrated a change. And I'll give you one quick example. Julie Kinzelman, Racine, Wisconsin, took a beach that was so bad that when I went and dug my hand on it and picked it up, it smelled like raw sewage. It has now been redone as its natural habitat with wetlands, new growth. Now there's, she was nationally recognized for literally transforming a beach from a dump into its natural state again. She did it in less than 2 years.
Let me just add on one quick thing. That's why we see that the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is so durable. Not because there's some sort of abstract notion that this is good for the Great Lakes. Right. That the benefits of these things are showing up in every community, and the community can point to their work, not EPA's work, not NOAA's work, not John Allen's work, not the Office of the Great Lakes' work, the community's work, who finally decided to turn their face back to their water. Needed some resources to do it, but GLRI is durable because GLRI provides results to people in communities.
GLRI is a great thing. I strongly support it, and I feel that we're lucky that we have bipartisan support for it, but there are a few issues. For example, I don't know if it was the, I think it was the Great Lakes Commission just got a $750,000 grant to find out if the work that's been paid for by the GLRI on agriculture is actually working. So I question that.
Go ahead. I had a question. I'm Karen Schaefer. I'm a freelance public radio journalist based in Oberlin, Ohio. I haven't been covering the Great Lake Erie quite as long as Tom, but a good long time. I pitch stories to national networks like NPR and Marketplace and so on, as well as regional places. And one of the challenges as a reporter that I always have is convincing an editor that there's a reason to tell a Great Lakes story in a national context. And now, you've talked about its economic impact, but sorry, editors still think of it not as the Fresh Belt, but as the Rust Belt. Mm-hmm. They see the challenges, not the opportunities. They see the fact that we're protecting the water as a natural resource instead of using it as a commodity as kind of protectionist. And they don't see the challenges that we're facing as anything relating to the rest of the country. So I would like you to tell us why the Great Lakes is a national story.
So Karen's question is, and she has trouble selling the Great Lakes as a national story to some of the editors that she's dealing with on a freelance basis, and why this is a national story.
So one of the things when I, as a mayor, I sat on the Wisconsin Coastal Management Commission, U.S. Conference of Mayors, Water Council, and the Great Lakes and Lawrence Cities Initiative Board of Directors. And one of the things I asked all the organizations to do, the 100-plus organizations in the United States to do and all of our mayors to do, was something that was illegal. And everybody said, well, we'll get sued and liability issues and everything else. And what I told them to do is at noon, we pick the day and we shut down the water everywhere without notice. It isn't until you're Toledo or Grand Rapids or name the city where your water is turned off until you figure out that this stuff is pretty doggone important. Or you're like me climbing in the mountains of Colorado and you run out of water and you're going, you know, your head spinning because you're in altitude sickness. The fact is that we will never get people to understand until it's too late.
It's interesting.
That's the problem.
I'm sorry, go ahead. It's interesting that the national media has had no problem finding it newsworthy, as the New York Times did this week with the algae bloom or with the drinking water shutoff. Seems to me a harder sell is a positive story about the Great Lakes. But that's true of any positive story, isn't it? That why would an editor want to hear good news?
Well, let me. I have a. That's a great answer. Both of them were great answers. I almost.
That's your sixth of the day.
We agree again.
We do. It's kind of sickening.
Told him I was going to rock his world today. Right? two ideas come to mind very quickly. One is one of the great national stories for the Great Lakes is the profound effect of the Sioux Locks. That 3% of U.S. GDP goes through the Sioux Locks, and we have a Sioux Lock that could fail at any time. Michigan's unemployment would go to 20%. Kentucky's unemployment, Illinois' unemployment, Iowa's unemployment. 3% of U.S. GDP goes through the Sioux Locks. That should be of interest to the other M states besides Michigan, to Minnesota. Well, that is to Minnesota, but to Montana, Missouri, and Mississippi. That is a national story that will have profound implications to a universal economy. Sure. So the Great Lakes aren't necessarily or solely the parochial localized interest. But the other side of that is what we do in the Great Lakes is understand sort of the contours of managing within our watershed. It's a national story and a national importance because we live within the boundaries of its own hydrology. It's not a national story because we do or we don't ship water nationally. It's a national story because we look at the contextualization and the management of a resource at scale within its framework. We don't pretend it to be something else. We think that really provides the contours of what thoughtful, careful management is. Doesn't mean we have everything right. But we have the other side of this national story is you have shared governance of 20% of the world's fresh water. And we do that through the lens of 8 states, 2 provinces, 2 countries. I will point to very few examples worldwide, and we've studied them worldwide, from the Baltic to other places.
Israel.
Well, other parts of the world where shared governance is not so easily done as it is in the Great Lakes. There is no single Great Lakes decision maker. And I will tell you categorically that not always 8 states agree with each other. However, we have deep institutional mechanisms that have built up around the care and thoughtful management of the Great Lakes. Do we have to get better? Completely. Do we disagree on aspects of it? Of course
no.
We do. But that's the power of why this is such an important story, because we understand how that fits within the context of its own hydrology.
And given who's running the U.S. federal government, thank God we share management of the Great Lakes with Canada. I mean, we've actually got a country, one of the two, that really cares about water as something other than a product.
We had another question here, right behind Karen.
I'm Pam Barnes. I'm representing the National Park Service, so it's really intriguing to listen to these conversations, and I want to go back to the psychology of relating to the Great Lakes. Something that I struggle with, in a park protecting 22 miles of the Cuyahoga River,
yeah,
the one that caught on fire, empties into Lake Erie. We're doing great things. And
absolutely.
And if you look at our table out there, there's all kinds of great things happening. Mm-hmm. And what I'm finding is we pitch stories that are positive to the media, and nobody responds. So I had to deal with an incident where somebody was shot in the national park. Guess what? The media was all over that story. So how do we make that the bridge of telling positive stories? Because what I see on our park level is it's kind of like the psychology is when you see someone else doing something good and you see the results of that, you want to jump on that bandwagon. So how can you get your editors to take those stories and get them to cover the positive things? Because it's like a snowball effect of people doing positive things.
In NPR.
Have the governor make, have the state or public official make things better, make a change, and we'll come out and cover. Can I ask you a question?
Yes, please. Yeah,
so,
yes.
if I could ask Mr. Allen, and going back to the diversion issue, Foxconn would straddle the Great Lakes and Mississippi basins as electronic manufacturers in probably in Racine County. What was the state of Michigan's initial reaction to Foxconn maybe being in the Great Lakes Basin and water issue again?
I just haven't looked at the details of Foxconn's proposal, so I don't have an initial reaction to it. I usually try to follow it based on what the underlying fact set will be, and I just haven't studied it yet.
In general, if a really big company, 3,000 to 13,000 people, could affect the Great Lakes Basin, is that a potential thing that Michigan will look at, do you think?
I think how it fits within the contours of the compact, what the mechanisms for us to take a look at that, I think that is important. We will continue to engage in that compact conversation. How much of that will be at the compact level and how much is it sort of a Wisconsin decision, I don't know, because I haven't seen the proposal. But it's something that we're very mindful of, and we will continue to engage, as you saw us engage deeply in the Waukesha issue.
And that was Chuck Kornblock from...
Sorry.
That's okay. Wisconsin Public Radio. In the back.
So I kind of wanted to go back to... I'm Bella. I just don't know why I'm from the University of Michigan.
What was your first name? I'm sorry?
Bella.
Bella. Okay.
So I wanted to go back to what you were bringing up with community psychology and environment as it pertains to agricultural communities within Michigan, specifically, you know, like going through the basin. And I feel like and there's a lot of silence in those communities, you know, because they are from my very industry of industrial agriculture that not only, you know, produces the runoff to Lake Erie, you know, that huge amount that is causing these algorithms, but also the industry itself that is using so much water and it's
So the question then being, how do you protect a resource and still be viable economically? Is that sort of what you get? Is that what you're getting at?
How do you invigorate a community and kind of reinstate that pride and also a sense of ownership that isn't really there anymore? Especially, I know a lot more about Southeast Michigan in terms of that's kind of statewide.
So then, how do you engender? Environmental consciousness and a respect for a resource in areas where that doesn't seem to exist.
First of all, I would turn to you guys, to you all, and what I mean by that is the millennials. And here's one thing that I was shocked by when I was at a National Press Club meeting, was that they had the five of the largest companies in the world were at the meeting, and they're talking about climate change, and the companies were telling how they're going to change the things that they're doing, from the ports to the cities that they're located to everything else, and start ramping up to move things on higher ground. Okay? But then the one told me about a project that he was doing in his company, and we're talking tens of thousands of employees, about introducing an internal environmental policy. And he did it because of the millennials who demanded it. So here's a person, this was a gentleman, who's big at one of the presence of the biggest companies in the world. He's changing his policies because of his employees. If we want to get to the heart of some of these issues, we have to start making these mainstay issues. And you all have to start pushing old guys like us a little harder. Because that's the way that this is going to work, as a lot of this is organic. you know, we've been talking about issues here, and both of my colleagues are right. None of this is easy, and there's no silver bullet to any of this. But it starts organically. My kids know nothing other than recycling, and when you don't, they look at you like, Dad, seriously? So when you start moving this stuff up the ladder organically in what matters to you, then it starts working up the chain.
Well, let me answer it this way, and maybe I'll answer it with a question also. So if you posit the notion that agriculture is moving from sort of small-scale family, sort of historical farming, to larger and larger corporatized types of farming, then you will see additional pressure from the capital markets on the way that that industry will perform. That large-scale corporate interests are interested in capital investments, and those capital investments come from large investors and large financial houses, for instance. So the question is, do those entities react to social interest in the same way, right? Small-scale farmer versus a large corporate farmer. What we're seeing is, and what we actually spent a fair amount of time looking at, is sort of the conditioning of the flow of money through capital markets. And how does that conditioning, I think it's early stage, I don't think you've seen a really fully maturation of this yet, but as large capital is deployed through its capital markets, how does that start to change the expectations of the underlying actors? Right, as capital flows from one of the Morgan Stanley, for instance, or Goldman Sachs, into deployed capital at large scale, all the way down to the farm, does that chart start to change the way the farm looks at its requirements and in the way that it ports back its product back to the market? So it's not just through the social regulatory side, but we also think that there's growing conditioning of the flow of money around things like the principles of responsible investing. You may be shocked, and I think this is a really another top-line story. We think roughly $87 trillion is now acting under something called the principles of responsible investing. How many of you knew that? The principles of responsible, the Harvard Endowment at 30-some billion dollars, don't quote me on that number, but, you know, more than I have, right, is operating at some level under the principles of responsible investing, meaning they're looking to move their monies into markets in ways that drive markets differently. Whether it's series shareholder activities or whether it's conditioning of the flow of money, money is looking for good homes, and that home has to comport more and more with sustainable principles. So we think that there's not just sort of the local, social, necessarily governmental policy side, but also through the conditioning of capital markets. We think these are profound notions that are just starting to mature. But at the end of the day, $87 trillion is a lot of money, all looking for opportunities to manifest itself in ways that comport more and more with social conscience. But there's a lot more work to be done here and some really elegant writing to be done in this space.
One last idea, maybe you've already pitched this story, but I think there's a story to be, or a hypothesis to be tested, and to what extent the problems of Lake Erie are a result of well-intended but unfortunate environmental policies, including the ethanol mandate and the increase in no-till farming. I mean, those are both policies that were believed to be strong environmentally that may or may not be contributing to Lake Erie's problems. The IJC, which I left in January, was doing a study on the ethanol incentive to see what role it played. But that seems to me to be a good one. And maybe it's being done or it has been done, but I just haven't read it.
And we have a hard stop at noon, so Thomas, ask your question, and then if it requires more than a 30-second answer, we can...
No, it was a follow-up to what he just said. The ethanol mandate is being discussed in the Farm Bill, National Wildlife Federation, and they discussed recently that the U.S. government had given farmers an incentive to farm to the edge of their property, to the dismay of... And now we're caught, you know, because of the... the mandate on them to grow so much corn for ethanol, now we're faced with more polluted rivers and streams. They'll, because there's less bumper strip, maybe you could address or amplify that. What is that? What do you expect in the farm bill to help? You know, do you feel that the corn ethanol mandate will be addressed in a meaningful way, and that in order to create more buffer strips and other things.
So the question is, will the ethanol mandate be addressed in a meaningful way in the farm bill, which is up for reauthorization next year?
Short answer is no. I just don't see it. I guess I'm old and cynical. So
let me not end with a no, and I'm not going to address that question. But all I'll say is, I love working with these folks, and I love working with folks like this. It is the hallmark of the Great Lakes that we understand and can work together and continue to explore ideas. We agree more often than they would like to acknowledge.
We all love the lakes.
But we find solutions together, and that is the hallmark of the Great Lakes. And to me, that's one of the top-line stories. How does a region of 35 million people, of a $5 trillion economy, continue to manage the Great Lakes to the kinds of endpoints and public expectations that we have? That's what we're after together.
All right, I'm going to leave you on this.
Thank you.
Home of the best tasting water in America, as we see in Wisconsin. Just so you know.
Thank you.
Thank you.